my cardiovascular risk here? So here we get to, we have to play with things. Tissue. What's tissue composition determined by? Not only the fish you eat and the omega-3s you eat, but what are the background seed oils that you eat? Many background seed oils do contain linoleic acid, and it's elongated and desaturated very poorly into EPA and DHA. And by the way,
to pre-existing contamination of urban soils. However, when we looked into the literature, we found very few surveys of arsenic levels taken prior to the flooding, and none using the same sampling methodology that EPA used. To test this hypothesis, this theory, that the contamination of the sediment was due to pre-existing contaminated soils, we partnered with Dr. Howard Mielke, then of Xavier and now at Tulane University, to analyze pre-flooding soils for arsenic in New Orleans. Dr. Mielke is an expert on lead and soil contamination in New Orleans and has over the years amassed an extensive archive of soil samples taken from all over the city. Using spatial matching techniques, we were able to match the 70 sediment samples where EPA found high levels of arsenic after the flooding, shown here in this graph with red bars. The soil samples from Dr. Mielke's archive, which are the green bars. When we analyzed those sediments for arsenic, we saw a very clear pattern in which the soil samples taken after the flooding had on average 20 milligrams per kilogram more arsenic than the soil samples from those same areas prior to the flooding. We saw this pattern of contamination in each of the major flooded neighborhoods of New Orleans. As workers and residents returned to the city, there were multiple public health risks posed by the contaminant sediment. As the city dried out and cleanup efforts began, blowing dust was commonplace, posing a respiratory threat. Analyses of particulate matter found elevated levels of metals, including arsenic and chromium. In addition, people were exposed as they cleaned up surfaces and yards caked in sediment, as seen in the front yard of the house in the lower right-hand photo. Personal protective equipment, such as the couple in the top right photo are wearing, was unfortunately not the norm. Long-term, the sediment posed risk of contributing to or resulting in the contamination of residential soils. Arsenic is a known human carcinogen, has also been linked to other serious health problems, including birth defects, cardiovascular disease, skin abnormalities, neurological problems, and anemia. In March of this year, we looked a little closer at the longer-term risk of contaminated soils in New Orleans by partnering with local groups to conduct a study to assess arsenic levels in areas of concern. These areas included residential areas where post-flooding arsenic concentrations were above the Louisiana cleanup level, as well as playgrounds and schools where young children come into contact with soils. We took surface-level grab samples at 116 sites located around the city with help from local organizations and Dillard University students. We found varying levels of arsenic in these samples. For 70 residential sampling locations, we were then able to compare arsenic levels taken in samples prior to the flooding, directly after the flooding, and 1.5 years later. The good news is that for the majority of those samples, the levels taken found after 1.5 years later, this past March, were very similar to the levels we saw prior to the flooding. However, elevated levels of arsenic were still found throughout the city. About 10% of all the samples we took during that sampling event had levels of arsenic that exceeded the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality's cleanup level for arsenic of 12 milligrams per kilogram. The majority of these samples were taken from playgrounds and schoolyards, raising safety concerns for children. The highest level we found in our sampling was 41 milligrams per kilogram in a residential location, which exceeds the acceptable cancer risk range for arsenic in soils set by the US EPA. For playgrounds and schoolyards, we don't currently know the degree to which these sites were contaminated prior to the flooding. Our study found little evidence to support the contention made by the US EPA and Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality that the arsenic in the sediment was due to previously contaminated urban soils in New Orleans. However, the question of where the arsenic originated remains somewhat of a mystery. Some potential sources include the following: leaching of arsenic from wood treated with chromated copper arsenate, washing of soils contaminated due to the use of arsenic-containing pesticides, or trash incineration, deposition of industrially contaminated sediments from the canals and Lake Pontchartrain, and leakage from industrial sites. A study by researchers from the University of Florida looking at the arsenic content of debris piles resulting from Hurricane Katrina, like the one in this photo, found a significant quantity of arsenic-treated wood was utilized in the flood-impacted areas. In fact, they found that nearly a quarter of the wood waste was CCA-treated and that an estimated 1,740 tons of arsenic were disposed of throughout Louisiana and Mississippi following these hurricanes. Regardless of where exactly the arsenic came from, the sampling conducted to date suggests that attention is needed to address the contamination to prevent long-term public health impacts. This study was limited in the scope and the geographic scope and the density at which we were able to take samples. Additional sampling is needed and further investigation should be conducted to better characterize the extent of current day contamination. Particular focus should be made to evaluate areas where children could be exposed, such as playgrounds and schoolyards. Public education about the extent of contamination and risks of exposure is needed as cleanup and redevelopment projects move forward. Community involvement is key to successful cleanup efforts, and resources need to be made available to enable cleanup in all impacted areas. The photo here on this slide is from a project conducted by the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, where residents and volunteers gathered together to replace the top 6 inches of soil, put down new sod to ensure a safer redevelopment of the area. In conclusion, we found that the elevated levels of arsenic in the sediment left behind by the floodwaters in New Orleans were not solely the result of pre-existing contaminated soils. Instead, this contamination was a new potential environmental health risk that merits attention to prevent long-term public health impacts from ongoing soil contamination. The rebuilding of New Orleans needs the input and participation of all communities to ensure a safe and healthy reconstruction. The issue of arsenic-contaminated sediments and soils illustrates how the environmental health implications of a storm like Katrina are multiple, complex, and potentially long-lasting. Finally, there's much to be learned from the history of lead contamination in New Orleans. Prior to the hurricanes, nearly a quarter of inner-city New Orleans children had enough lead in their blood to be classified as lead poisoned and at risk for learning disabilities and behavioral problems. Rebuilding a healthier and more just New Orleans means identifying and eliminating soil contaminants such as lead and arsenic. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the work and contributions to this project by our local collaborators, Dr. Howard Milkey and Chris Gonzalez, for their work to help us evaluate pre-flooding arsenic concentrations, Dr. Lovell Aguarambo and his students who came out and helped us do some of the field sampling, Bryce White from the People's Environmental Center who assisted us with the sampling and logistics of doing the field work, Dr. Beverly Wright from the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, Al Wong, Gina Solomon, and others from NRDC, and the funders who made this work possible. Here are a few websites and additional resources on soil sampling and contamination issues in New Orleans, as well as rebuilding and reconstruction efforts. Thank you.
You've all read the topic. Current APHIS PPQ regulations on imported agricultural commodities are science-based and appropriately rigorous to protect U.S. agriculture while facilitating global trade. The Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, is a division of USDA responsible for monitoring imports and exports of agricultural products for the associated pests and diseases. And this involves largely inspecting shipments for new pests and the regulation of certain established pests. Plant Protection and Quarantine, or PPQ, is charged with safeguarding natural and agricultural plants from exotic threats such as insects, noxious weeds, and plant diseases. Before a new commodity can be imported, it is subject to a risk assessment by the USDA. And the three major components of the risk assessment are the actual formal initiation or recognition of the request to import and assessing the commodity under risk assessment for pest risk, and the development of a plan to manage the pest pest if it becomes established. The information in these risk assessments are largely based on scientific literature. However, the USDA does conduct some research if necessary, and results of the risk assessment influence policy and regulation of new commodities that are associated with pest disease concerns. Criticisms of the risk assessment process are that the actual process is not always clear to stakeholders, and there have been concerns raised that policy is influenced by politics and not entirely science-based. The strength of the risk assessment is dependent upon the availability of existing data in the literature. With this in mind, APHIS PPQ face many challenges to accomplish their goals in the future. And the goals are enforcing regulations without hindering trade, protecting our agriculture while still allowing new commodities to be imported, and then effectively managing and disseminating the data obtained in the risk assessment. And many external factors influence the effectiveness of the risk assessment, and those include national security and emerging trade issues, some government initiatives, and political activities. With that, I'll turn it over to Penn State.
I'm going to talk about CSRES land grant, NRCS partnership, and aligning programmatic goals in support of IPM. And I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not Mike Fitzner. Okay, unfortunately, Mike's mother had heart surgery, so he had to remain back closer to home in case there were some further emergencies. So he gave me the pleasure and liberty of talking about whatever I wanted to. So I'm going to do that today. So it's probably fortunate Mike isn't here. Let's see. Does the other one back up? Okay, the outline of the presentation, I'm going to give you a little background to how I got involved with this mess. And then I'm going to talk about IPM implementation from a national perspective.
So what I'm going to do is try and build on those previous two talks, which were excellent, and think a little bit about what it is that impacts what we grow. Since we know what we grow impacts what we eat, what actually helps determine what we grow? And I'm going to lay this in a historical context and in a policy context. And it's very appropriate because you may not be aware, but tomorrow the Senate votes on the farm bill that it's been negotiating for 3 or 4 months. And of any kind of legislation, federal or state, that huge farm bill is probably the one thing that most determines what we grow in this country. So Dr. Davis talked about conventional agriculture, and you know, it wasn't always conventional the way we currently practice it. It's what we now have is really sort of an industrialized model of agriculture, which is very yield focused, and that has come about for a number of reasons. Let me just point out this excellent source. Tim Lang is a food policy researcher in the United Kingdom who is very readable, and this book is excellent. And he talks about this productionist model that has come to bear. What it's replaced by and large is the picture of a farm that we still see on milk cartons and other food products, but really that you don't see much in the countryside anymore. And that model, that was kind of the pre-war, pre-industrial model, was primarily pastoral. It involved farms that grew a lot of different things instead of just one thing. And the resources that were used in that kind of agriculture were largely from on the farm.
About 100 years ago, 120 years ago, a whole variety of forces came into being that changed that model. Some of these were innovation and new technologies like tiles draining fields in Iowa, mechanization, new transportation infrastructure, and then the chemical revolution, which brought primarily fossil fuel-derived nitrogen fertilizers and pesticides. And all these have served to create this new conventional agriculture, which is really a productionist model. And that model, in contrast, is one that's very specialized, just like factories are, very concentrated in terms of what it produces and where it produces it. It's much more large in scale, not local in scale, and it makes very intensive use of off-farm resources, and these include a lot of fossil fuel-derived products. So the picture here is of a gentleman named Henry Wallace, and he was Franklin Roosevelt's agriculture secretary. And he thought long and hard about what were the factors that determined the agricultural landscape. Because during the time of the Great Depression, one thing we had was a huge glut in production of commodity crops like corn. We weren't producing soybeans yet, as Dr. Hiblin pointed out, but we had a lot of corn. And actually, the farmers couldn't sell it. They had so much of it, and nobody was buying it. And so it was just going to waste in the fields. And at the same time, people were hungry. And what Wallace observed is that because of some factors that are inherent to agriculture, these commodity farmers are going to tend to overproduce regardless of the price that they see. So if the price is low, they're going to try and produce more. If the price is high, like it is right now, they're going to try to produce more. And some of those factors are farmers love to see fence row production. Aesthetically, it looks really good to them. They don't like to see pockets of unfarmed land. For many of these corn farms, there isn't much else that they can farm on that land. One of the factors used to be that they were far from the urban market centers, so they couldn't grow things like fruits and vegetables prior to better shipping because they couldn't ship it in time to the markets without it spoiling, whereas grain crops were very shippable. And then maybe the most important factor is that to a lesser extent today, but still to a true extent, a single producer cannot affect the price in the marketplace. And so really, no matter how much any single producer produces, they're not going to affect the market price of corn. Well, what Wallace did was to put in place some policies that helped to create a very diverse landscape. And this is a schematic of a county in northeastern Iowa near Winnebago. And what you see from these colors, you don't have to read all the particulars, but what you notice is that it's a very diverse set of crops. It's a very diverse landscape. And this gives it some resilience, because biological systems that are diverse tend to have more resilience in the face of things like pest outbreaks or drought. But it also had another effect. Through a series of different mechanisms, Wallace put in place policies that actually managed the supply of corn so that people didn't overproduce. And one of the side benefits of that is that it took surplus corn off the market in times of glut, and it released it back onto the market when there were shortages, and it stabilized the price. It effectively acted like a minimum wage for farmers. It created a floor price, more or less. And so the farmers actually earned what it cost to produce their crop, and that kept them on their farms, which is a good thing. What it didn't include was any kind of direct payment or subsidy to these farmers. They didn't need it. They were getting paid for their work. They didn't need any direct payment. Well, since the mid-1970s, when the new agriculture secretary was Earl Butz, and he made it his mission to get rid of these old programs and to replace them or start replacing them with programs that specifically had as their intent cheap food and overproduction, primarily these commodity crops, corn and increasingly soybeans and other commodities. And his goal was fence row production. And it might seem kind of funny, but the rationale was to produce such enormous surpluses that we could export to other countries this cheap crop, and that would keep farmers in business. That didn't happen. Instead, what happened was that we saw 3.5 decades of consistently declining market prices for these commodities. Supply and demand, we produced more, and lo and behold, the market prices kind of dropped down to the barrel. Now keep in mind that what a farmer needs to break even is somewhere in the, I think, $2 or $3 a bushel range. And so for a substantial part of the last 35 years, farmers haven't even earned from the market what it cost them to produce these crops. So what has been put in place are explicit policies to keep farmers producing, to keep them out of bankruptcy, by giving them direct payments, subsidies. And these were so-called emergency payments under the 1996 Farm Bill, but it quickly became clear that they couldn't be emergency. They had to be semi-permanent in order to keep